Now the Israelis have a nudist camp on Taba, right by Egypt on the Gulf of Aqaba. Bathers sunning on the beach were dangerously within reach of Muslim guards patrolling near the spa. And now it says to cover up in the Koran, but those Hebrews hung it out to get a tan. So for fear of getting heated, the Egyptians just retreated, which provoked this novel thought for a peace plan. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. No need to hurl a rock across the fence if your enemy is being real attentive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get more room if you disrobe. Relations will improve around the globe. Now the colonel of the Egyptian police platoon made this comment as he peered beyond the dune. All these sabras on the Sinai really look a sight to mine eye, though I think we'd better take some action soon. As he turned, he saw the men of his fine crew, field glasses trained on each attractive Jew. So he went and gave the order to redefine the border 100 yards down farther from the view. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. You can unveil a devastating offensive. It's healthier than war and less expensive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get more room if you disrobe. Relations will improve around the globe. Now here's the surest way to end a running feud. Simply approach your adversary in the nude. If he or she's a prude, they'll think it's lewd and move away. Who knows, they might be in the mood, you win either way. So if you're fighting and you just can't take it, you just might try your luck at standing naked. Before they have another riot, Northern Ireland should try it. The whole world could ease its tensions if we'd only undertake it. I'd propose this brand new cure for hot disputes. Have the warring parties meet in birthday suits. Imagine how a summit conference might progress. Formalities abandoned as each delegate undressed. No harm in getting back to bare essentials. World leaders must admit it has potential. For uncovered, one can make appeals to what the other side reveals and see they're not so different after all. Take off your clothes to those you oppose. Be well exposed to your foes and strike a pose. No need to hurl a rock across the fence if your enemy is being real attentive. Strip to the buff, stick out your duff and strut your stuff. The sight of muff will be enough to halt the tough. Forget about an armored probe, you'll get results if you disrobe. Relations can improve around the globe. Oh yes indeed, relations will improve.
That was Mark Levy from Take Off Your Clothes. Actually, that's the title song to the same cassette CD, and I guess it's just a cassette and a CD at the moment. It's from Nuclear Records, if you're interested in getting a copy of it. Mark is a man who is local, and he can be reached at 338-7283. 338-7283. Interesting, this is so old, this is 1986, that it's still got the old 408 area code. It's now 831. But you want Mark's stuff, he's got great stuff. He writes about local issues, sings about local issues, and his cassettes and CDs are available. You can call him directly, or you can, of course, call the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, and I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrop's Beers Broadsides. That's a show that's going to be running for the next 3.5 hours. Going to be doing a special interview today with Robert Letterman, a New York City activist with ARTIST. And ARTIST is a group. It's an acronym for Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics, founded in 1993. It's about legal and the political struggle to get and maintain full First Amendment protection for the creation, display, and sale of art on New York City streets and in parks. Members of Artist have won numerous federal lawsuits about the right to sell art on public property without a license or permit. And I'm going to be reading some of the concerns that Robert's going to be addressing. He's been on the show before. Really an articulate and eloquent speaker, as well as an effective organizer from New York City who puts us all to shame here, but he does have more resources to work with there and more attorneys as well, but that's no reason we shouldn't be doing better here. So that's going to be at 10 o'clock. He's going to be calling in, hopefully. We'll be talking with him. We're also going to be discussing, kind of covering some local stuff on the 4th of July, a few local patriots. I'm going to be trying to get in touch with them and their struggles, not the kind that you read about in the Sentinel, but the kind you hear about on this show, who are fighting for the rights of poor and homeless people in this city and in this county. And if you want to call in and talk about any of these issues, we do have a studio line here, and the number is 427-3772, 427, Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC. That's the letters to use in case you are a numerophobic and don't want to look at the numbers. You can also email me if you're a computer bound, rnorse3@hotmail.com. And I will attempt to take the occasional glance at the screen. We actually do have the tape machine working and connected this time. My thanks, tip of the hat to the staff here and the hard workers and the collective members who are doing this. We actually don't have a staff. They are the staff. People who put things together do all the work here. And the rest of us who kind of come in and struggle along to, well, we don't do much struggling. We're fortunate enough to be able to put our shows on the air, and I thank the people at the core of Free Radio for their good work in keeping the station going. You can also help keep it going. You can even join the collective if you wish. It involves paying a monthly sum if you get a program. And you can actually learn more about this by going on the internet at www.freakradio.org. And you can get an application form there. All we have to do is get them to bring the application forms into the meetings, and they will consider it. It takes about a month, usually, and they want a tape from you and so forth. But you can be a broadcaster here as well. If you have a message for the station, a public service announcement, a gift you want to give, a question, comment, you can call the voicemail. That's off-air voicemail, 427-4523, 427-4523. Again, the on-air number to get in touch and to be on the air here with me, or actually with any other broadcaster, is 427-3772. And in case you have something you want to pass my way, and you don't want it on the air, but you want to talk to me about it, and you want me to get back to you, I have a voicemail that's 24 hours, although it's not connected to a live phone, but I check it regularly. 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833. Many of you who listen to the show regularly have heard this endlessly. I apologize, but it's for new listeners and also for those of you who may have forgotten what those numbers are. So, what do we got here? Well, let's talk about Robert Letterman, because he's going to be coming on the show, and his recent struggles. I'd like to give a little background so I can kind of prepare you for his interview, assuming that it happens, and I think it will, at 10 o'clock. He has been concerned of late of a New York City effort to essentially remove independent street artists and street vendors, and he's been particularly focusing on vendors, commercial vendors. That may not be so hot an issue in Santa Cruz. I mean, here in Santa Cruz, if you want to get a permit, you have to go through the city council, and it's kind of a complicated, difficult process. And there are a few people who have vending permits. I don't know of any local jewelers. I don't know of any street artists who have any kind of vending permits. But there are a few folks who sell ice cream vendors get permits. I think maybe flower sales people get vending permits. Costs money. Again, as I said, goes through the whole city council here in Santa Cruz. I mean, but in New York City, it's different. I'm going to read a bit from this. New York City licenses about 4,400 street fairs and block parties each year. Actually, what he's doing here now is he has an interesting discussion of how the same people who want to get rid of vendors or turn them all into kind of corporate entities that are sold to large corporations with independent vendors essentially shoved out have no problem with, they claim that their concern is traffic congestion and street clutter. Yet, he says, New York licenses about 4,400 street fairs and block parties each year. Not 4,400 individual vendors at these events, but 4,400 different events, most of which have a few hundred to a few thousand vendors each, blocked off streets and avenues, gambling, the vending and drinking of alcoholic beverages, food vending by unqualified food vendors, fixed games of chance known as con games, etc. All the street vendors in all of New York City cause less congestion in 1 year than many of these events cause in just one afternoon. Pickpocketing, assault, serious accidents, and even murders are fairly common. The city officials promoting these events and posing for photos in them are among the most vicious critics of street vendors, including Christine Nicholas, Rudy Giuliani, and Alan Gerson. The BIDs, that's the Business Improvement Districts, which we have one here ourselves, the Downtown Business Association in Santa Cruz, but they have plenty of them in New York City. They kind of gobbling up the city. The downtown business improvement districts. These are districts that fund themselves by coercive taxes on businesses. You can't opt out of a bid, and then they use the money to buy private police forces that police the areas and engage in seizures of the public space. Here in Santa Cruz, of course, we have the hosts, and then we have funding for CSOs, community service officers, which actually goes to the city council, but is pressured through the business our local downtown business association. I'm not against street fairs per se, writes Robert Letterman, but I am against them in the context of the city's war on vendors. Consider that in Soho, for example, you have a city council member, Alan Gerson, who is an outspoken enemy of all vendors. Gerson is always whining about street artists congesting Soho streets. In the exact same district, Gerson's district, you have the two-week-long Little Italy Festival run, according to the Godfather films, by the Mafia. I used to live in Little Italy. That fair is a nonstop nightmare of noise, stink, drunken tourists, and congestion. It congests all of Lower Manhattan, blocks the bridges and tunnels, and causes more rat-nourishing garbage to be generated in one day than what is generated by many U.S. cities. It may be called the San Gennaro Festival, but what goes on there is about as religiously oriented as a McDonald's or a Burger King. Did Gerson ever try to stop that festival? No, but he's constantly running a crackdown on Chinese merchants for blocking the sidewalks with boxes of vegetables in Chinatown right across the street. Legal street artists and disabled veteran vendors are given illegitimate summons on Canal Street every day. Did even one Little Italy restaurant ever get a summons from the DCA? When the festival is not on, the restaurants in Little Italy place tables and chairs not only on the sidewalk, but even in the street. Would Gerson dare to complain about these gross violations of consumer affairs law? No, because he's too busy trying to get the sanitation department to crush unattended art displays on West Broadway and setting up fake street artists groups run by his stooge, Larry White, to agree to new restrictions on us. And again, in Santa Cruz, we have a similar situation where you have the city council essentially permitting all kinds of violations by merchants, putting up displays without permits, putting up signs that are inappropriate. You have the police department setting up tables next to buildings. It's illegal to set up a table within 10 feet of a building, a display device, it's called, thanks to the Kennedy-Rotkin downtown ordinances, which are really designed to go after homeless people, political activists, and street performers, mainly homeless people. So you have the same kind of double standard. In fact, the double standard is what made Judge Barracuda Barton in the spring of this year throw out the case against Steve Argue. Unfortunately, he didn't throw out the law, which said that every 60 minutes you have to move along. But the original reason he threw it out was because the businesses did not have such a law, and they were allowed to set up permits. What the city council did in a sneaky backdoor move is it changed the law slightly so that it didn't appear so egregious. So then it subsumed under another code section the idea that, oh, anyone can go get a permit just like the businesses can. And I think I've talked on the air about what happens when you try to get a permit for setting up a table for more than an hour. They impose all kinds of restrictions on you. Now, in point of fact, in Santa Cruz, people set up tables all the time for more than an hour. But as you will hear later in the show, we interviewed Joe Williams last night, a Peace and Freedom Party candidate and local street performer. The police have been going after not only HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and its table in front of Borders, not only Jason Pascal, the vendor downtown, I say vendor, the spiritual reader who's in front of the, near the Cooper House, but they went after a local table, a political table, an anti-Bush table, in front of Fahrenheit 9/11, telling them they could only be there for an hour. Now, they haven't given tickets yet, but they are intimidating and threatening people in Santa Cruz, essentially encouraging them to abandon their First Amendment rights, just as is happening in New York City, and that's why it's productive to look at that. Though, again, the subject in New York City is about vendors in this particular article, and we're talking about commercial vendors, small commercial vendors. That's what street artists should be here in Santa Cruz. They should have the right, they do have the right, actually, they just don't know about it, and they're intimidated away from it, to show their own artwork and to sell it on the street. To sell it, yes, to sell it. And that's, if it's a First Amendment activity, of course, they should be allowed to sell it without any kind of restriction in terms of permit or license. I suppose a reasonable regulation so that traffic can go through is fine, although that has been construed in Santa Cruz to eliminate 75% of the space for political tablers, for individuals with little cups if you're a panhandler, or for street performers. You have to be at least 10 feet away from a building, a bench, a telephone, a kiosk, a crosswalk, and so on. A whole series of restrictions which eliminates, as I said, most of the downtown sidewalk and all of all other sidewalks in all other commercial districts in Santa Cruz. It is clearly unconstitutional. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with the Supreme Court that feels we should all identify ourselves to the police, even if there's no probable cause for the police to stop us and seek to interrogate us, we're in trouble. We have a city council that reflects in its own way that Supreme Court mentality. What? Scott Kennedy? Resource Center for Nonviolence's Scott Kennedy? Mayor Scott Kennedy? What? Vice Mayor Mike Rotkin? ACLU board member? Certainly not. A court couldn't be. Well, look at the laws they passed. Look at what they do. Not what they say, but what they do. If you want to call in to talk, and this is the 4th of July, so it's the perfect day to talk about it, 427-3772 is the phone number to call, 427-3772. Or, of course, you can email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, which I'll be checking shortly. Reading some more from Robert Letterman's article. Many vendors ask me for info on street fairs. Here's some solid info and some opinionated advice. Street fairs are about taking away the rights of vendors and selling those rights back to them. The organizers of these fairs buy a license from the DCA, and then the DCA advises vendors who've been harassed off the streets because they supposedly cause congestion to sell in these street fairs for hundreds of dollars a day in fees paid to the organizers. You can find promotions for these privately run events right on the DCA website. If somebody's not getting paid off, they should be. Can anybody on this list explain how 20 independent vendors on a block is a safety hazard, but 200 vendors paying an organizer a fee on the same street is a great benefit to the community? Some of these organizers run hundreds of these fairs, all of which are virtually identical, and most of which have no real ethnic, religious, racial, or cultural purpose other than to take money, or to make money, for the organizers. If you've been to them, you will have observed that the vending is all the most commercial and crappy merchandise, and all of it is identical from festival to festival, and none of it has any connection to the supposed theme of each festival. Know your enemy for the hypocrites they are. Fight for your real rights, and don't be conned into giving up the public street for these fairs. By paying a fee to these street fairs, you are weakening your own rights on the street and playing right into the city's plan for destroying vending. But for those intent on selling in street fairs, below are some links. You get some links on how to deal with this. If you're interested in Robert Letterman's website, by the way, let me give it to you. It's Robert Letterman, Robert, L-E-D-E-R-M-A-N. And actually, that's, I'm looking at his email address. So it's at worldnet at .att.net. But for his actual, for the website, you might want to go to www.openair.org. Check www.openair.org. And, or you can Google for Robert Letterman, L-E-D-E-R-M-A-N. Or you can stay tuned and listen to him talk at 10. And he is quite a speaker, so I encourage you to do that. He also writes, he gave us a couple of interesting stories, which are kind of fun. He sent these to me. Here's one from the Victoria, Australia Herald and Weekly Times. Street artist painted into a corner. An artist who swallows milk and food dye, then vomits in banks and shops, could face fines and criminal charges. City Council staff are on alert for Amal Lala, who claims her Technicolor yawns are a protest against corporate greed. Targets of her performances include Westpac and National Banks in Collins Street, a Safeway supermarket, and Flinders Street Station. Police said yesterday that the unfunded artist could face charges over the vomit vandalism if complaints were lodged. And Melbourne City Council bylaw officers can fine the Newport artist up to $250 if they catch her in the act. The RMIT public art graduate told the Herald Sun she swallowed up to 2 liters of milk and chose different colored dyes depending on her target. She drank bright red for attacks on bank ATMs, green for the supermarket, and used black at Flinders Street Station. But after 5 months of protests, Layla yesterday vowed to stop the stomach-turning stunts. It's not very good for my body, she said. Kimberly Kitching said every effort would be made to prosecute Lala if she continued her campaign. This is not a standard of expression the community will accept. Connex spokesman Andrew Cassidy said he understood Lala vomited in May on Flinders Street Station's Platform 4. The act could be considered offensive behavior under the Transport Act. We're talking about Australia here. And future performances would attract fines. The alleged artwork posed a safety standard and could have even delayed services, he said. Customers find it very unpleasant, and we had to clean up the results of her performance. Westpac spokeswoman Julia Quinn said the bank respected a person's right to artistic expression. We'd also hope she'd respect the people who use ATMs and clean up after herself, she said. If it continued and she became a nuisance to customers, we might take further action. Stained patches from the bile-filled protests were visible yesterday on the Collins Street footpath. A Victoria police spokeswoman said Lala could be charged with offensive behavior, even willful or criminal damage, but no formal complaints have been made. 10 people could stand there and call it art, and another 10 could say we are extremely offended, she said. Layla said she was worried her attacks on corporate power affected cleaning staff the most. I did think about that. There's got to be other ways, she said. She thought passersby would understand her message, even though she made no attempt to explain it. It's about making people think, she said. I've often suggested this as a response to rape, vomiting. But I haven't been raped, so I don't know. Can't say. Here's another article. Artist serving 6-month sentence says she was railroaded. Washington. Alina Sassauer couldn't bring herself to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. Convicted of disrupting Congress, the judicial activist from New York refused to accept probation with conditions imposed by the judge that she believed were onerous and unconstitutional. So instead of walking freely from the courtroom, Sassauer earlier this week was sentenced to the maximum 6 months in prison for the misdemeanor, even though prosecutors had recommended that the petite 48-year-old woman serve no time in jail. It's a horrible thing to be here. It's beyond description, Sassauer said Friday during an interview in the warden's conference room of the D.C. jail. But to be in jail on the 4th of July when we celebrate what it means to be an American and the way we exercise our rights, well, a spokesman for the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said the sentence seemed unusually excessive for what amounted to asserting her First Amendment rights. 6 months is what you get in D.C. for decking someone, said Jack King, himself a criminal defense lawyer. This woman is being punished for being obnoxious. Sassauer of White Plains, New York, confounded the New York-based Center for Judicial Accountability, which seeks to allow ordinary citizens input in the confirmation process for federal judges. Last year, she became interested in the nomination of New York Judge Richard Wesley to the Second Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals. She attempted to convince the staffs of Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer, both Democrats from New York, that Wesley was unfit for the federal branch. One day before Sassauer attended a Judiciary Committee meeting on the nomination in May 2003, Senate staffers alerted U.S. Capitol Police, who contacted Sassauer and warned her not to disrupt the hearing, according to court records. As the hearing in the Dirksen Building neared its conclusion, Sassauer demanded to be heard by Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican of Georgia, the presiding and only senator at the hearing. Her outburst continued after the gavel came down, ending the hearing, and as a police officer tried to escort her from the courtroom, she allegedly grabbed onto a chair to resist expulsion. Wesley was ultimately confirmed. Her trial in April, the trial of Sassauer, for disrupting the hearing, was equally tumultuous. Acting as her own attorney over the week-long proceeding, Sassauer repeatedly clashed with D.C. Superior Court Judge Brian F. Holman, who at one point had her removed from the courtroom. The jury took only a couple of hours before finding Sassauer guilty of disorderly conduct, a misdemeanor which carried a maximum 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. At the sentencing Monday, prosecutors recommended a suspended sentence of 5 days in jail, 6 months probation, and a course in anger management. But Holman told Sassauer he wanted to place her on probation for 2 years, assuming she agreed to the following conditions: an anger management course, a commitment to stay away from all buildings in the Capitol complex, the judge would supply a map, no contact with members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, including Senator Clinton, and letters of apology to committee members and U.S. Capitol police officers, admitting her wrongdoing and showing remorse. No, Sassauer said. The apology was the coup de grace, Sassauer said Friday. Maybe I could have accepted the rest, even though it would have affected my work monitoring judicial nominations, but I couldn't lie. Clad in an orange jumpsuit over a white T-shirt and orange slip-on sneakers, a blue and white ID band on her right wrist, Sassauer carried a Bible she borrowed from a cellmate. The prosecutors hadn't requested these conditions, she said, punctuating her remark with animated gestures. I was railroaded during the trial. Her legal advisor, Mark Goldstone, said the whole trial seemed reminiscent of the old Soviet Union. These are conditions you put on someone who attacks a senator with a knife. On May 7th, testimony by Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld before the Senate Armed Services Committee was interrupted by demonstrators who held up a banner and chanted, "Fire Rumsfeld." They were escorted out of the building, but not charged. Judge Holman declined to comment on the case because an appeal is pending. Calls requesting comment from Senators Clinton and Schumer were not returned. Sassauer said she spends 23 and a half hours in her cell and is allotted 30 minutes in an outdoor yard. Asked if she had any regrets, she shook her head. When you are held in these conditions, you don't know how you will go on, she said, but if it takes the horror of my incarceration to shed light on the process. Defense Attorney King said the D.C. jail was one of the most unpleasant prison facilities he had visited. It's not a place you want to spend the night, he noted, much less 6 months. That's from the Philadelphia Inquirer, the case of Ms. Sassauer, whose crime was trying to say something at a Senate judiciary confirmation hearing beyond the time of the gavel banging down, and actually not being allowed to speak even during that time. It's interesting here, you may remember, those of you who have been listening to this show or those of you who watch city council meetings on the air, that council member Mike Rotkin, vice mayor, complained of activist Becky Johnson, who was, the city spent more than $10,000 convicting of chalking peace signs on the sidewalk in erasable chalk, that she was whining because she was convicted and not just taking her sentence like a woman and going to jail as, say, Martin Luther King did, because it was an act of, quote, civil disobedience. Well, of course, Rotkin is wrong. It wasn't civil disobedience. It was simply a First Amendment expression. But here's a woman who's also in a similar situation. She's not engaging in civil disobedience. She's trying to assert her First Amendment rights. And should she take her sentence lying down and say nothing and whine so that she won't be accused of whining? No. No, she's doing the right thing, and so was Becky Johnson. Hi, you're on the air on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yes, Robert, this is Robert Letterman.
Hey, Robert, how are you
East
doing?
Coast. Good.
I've just been reading one of your emails here aloud, the one that both the two stories you sent about the Australia vomit artist. You may remember that one?
I do.
And then, of course, Ms. Sassauer, who is, I guess, still in jail today, right?
Right.
And I also read your brief description of how street fairs and block parties each year are a way of essentially co-opting and ripping off street artists and destroying their venue the rest of the year.
Yes.
So, welcome to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. You're, of course, calling from New York City.
Actually, I'm calling from New Jersey,
but okay.
Right near New York City.
It's in the same general area. Yeah. Realizing we've read those articles up to now,
okay.
What should the audience know to understand what's happening with street vendors and artists in New York City? Give us an update.
Well, I always like to put things in the larger context, so I think as anybody who reads any newspapers or watches TV, let alone if they do any radical or political activity, understands at this point there's a huge crackdown on freedom of speech in this country. And it's on all kinds of levels. Some of it even reaches up to the major media being censored about a breast being shown, Howard Stern being censored right off of the radio in many stations, and trickling down to the lowest level, which is individuals who use the public sidewalks in this country either for simply freedom of speech in a political sense or for vending of First Amendment protected materials. As some of your listeners may know, I've been very involved in the vending issue for about 10 years as far as fighting for those rights and have won a number of lawsuits about it. In terms of what's going on most recently in New York, the city has found itself in a quandary because of the lawsuits that my group, Artist, has won protecting the First Amendment rights of street artists. Their plan to basically destroy vending hit a huge roadblock. And that plan was, a central part of it was to get rid of the First Amendment protected vendors so that the city could sell all this potentially incredibly lucrative public space, the sidewalks, for corporate advertising. They even went and passed a law, which in New York is called the Street Furniture Initiative, and it's a law that allows the city to give out a $2 billion contract to one company to put advertising kiosks all over the sidewalk. And part of the sales pitch to potential companies is that we're going to get rid of the vendors who theoretically compete with these advertising companies because they'd be using the exact same section of the sidewalk, a section which is owned by the public and held in trust for them to use, obviously, for transportation, but also for communication and other First Amendment protected activities. So most recently, because they can't succeed, it appears, in getting rid of street artists, they've decided to go after the one other group of vendors that actually has rights, and that's disabled war veterans. Now, considering that this country is knee-deep in a war against terror, supposedly, and that every day the main article in every newspaper is another soldier being killed, a bunch more being wounded, and even with the censored reports from Iraq, we know that there are thousands of American servicemen and women that are coming back to the United States physically, mentally, emotionally incapacitated due to their service. You would think that here in New York City, where quite a few of the people that are in Iraq are from here, you would think that they'd be interested in protecting their rights. In New York State, there's a law that was passed in 1896, which said that disabled veterans could vend on any street in the city. Now, that wasn't doing a whole lot for disabled veterans, but it was doing something. It guaranteed them some possibility to make a living. Over the years, business improvement districts have gradually chipped away at that law. And most recently, in February of this year, they passed an amended version of it, which banned disabled veteran vendors from basically all of Midtown Manhattan. Now, again, in the context that we're in this war, that every politician is making speeches about patriotism and about how much they love soldiers and the veterans and how much these people are doing for the country and for freedom, the real fact is that behind the scenes, these same elected officials are working on banning these disabled veterans from all of Midtown Manhattan. And I'm now involved in a lawsuit with the disabled veteran vendors to overturn that law. And a number of things have come out in the course of the lawsuit. One of the claims that we're making is that when a disabled veteran is vending, that besides the vending activity, there's a First Amendment activity going on there, partly because these guys and some women wear, in some cases, their uniforms. In other cases, they wear hats and other distinctive clothing that identifies them as veterans. They're also required by law to wear an ID visible outside their clothes, which states that they're a disabled veteran. So whether they want to talk about it or not, the public comes up to them and says, hey, you know, what unit were you in? What war did you fight in? What was your experience? Et cetera, and so on. So there's a lot of communication about being a veteran that these people do while they're vending. We believe that, therefore, they're entitled to First Amendment protection, which would mean, in this context, that you can't just arbitrarily ban them from the most important commercial district in the city. Also, we had a hearing in federal court about a month ago. The city, by not preparing, allowed some very important revelations to come out. Here in New York, we have what are called planters. I'm not sure if you have them in your city. You might.
We do.
Okay. They're big concrete or steel boxes located alongside the curb. Some of them actually have plants or small trees. Most of them, at least here in New York, have nothing but dirt and garbage in them. Believe it or not, in Manhattan alone, there are tens of thousands of these, some of them as big as 8 feet in length. They weigh 500 to 1,000 pounds. And they're all over the very district where the veterans are being banned. Well, we in federal court, we had this hearing, and the city, I testified on behalf of the veterans about these planters. I submitted as evidence about 500 digital photographs that I took of them. And I explained how the business improvement districts put these planters there to take away spaces from vendors. Then the city put on its witness to rebut me, who's the main police official in charge of vending. And I suppose they didn't brief him properly because the judge began to ask him, Lieutenant, why are all these planters there if you know? And he testified totally honestly. He said they're all there because it's to take away spaces from legal vendors. Well, why is this significant? The city has argued for years that vendors congest the street and cause a safety hazard. So the city's solution to the safety hazard is to fill the streets with these huge concrete boxes. Clearly, the congestion claim on their part was a lie, and that's now come out in court. So the city officials are in an uproar now. They don't know what they're going to do because this testimony alone is going to, it's like a crack in a dam. Right now it's just a little crack, but over time it's going to weaken the whole dam. The whole structure that they built to prevent vending is going to start crumbling, and they're really upset about it. And as a result, in the course of this disabled veteran vendors lawsuit, city officials have now made three different attempts to basically, I don't know any other way to say it, to bribe or to buy off the plaintiffs in the case. They've actually offered them jobs, selling, believe it or not, selling souvenirs on the street with the New York City logo on it, if you could believe it. Now, these are the defendants in a lawsuit trying to hire the plaintiffs to work for them. I've never heard of anything like this, certainly not legitimately. They've made other efforts to try to compromise this lawsuit, but the veterans are holding fast, and they're going to stand up for the full rights that they're entitled to legally and certainly politically and socially. If anybody would have a right to vend on the street, it was a disabled war veteran.
Robert, what do they vend generally? What do most of the vets vend?
Well, they tend to vend what's called in New York general merchandise, which is inexpensive items that could range from jewelry to cigarette lighters to playing cards, articles of clothing. They're not necessarily First Amendment vendors in terms of the materials they sell. And these are not people that are making their own merchandise like the street artists do. But what they sell is really quite apart from who they are and why they have a right to vend. And a large part of the business that they get is because the public wants to do business with them. In other words, the public feels a debt of gratitude to these people, an obligation, and it feels that it's doing something for them when they buy their merchandise.
Well, you say this law dates back from the 1890s, 1896?
Yeah.
why has the law not been successfully overturned up to now? I mean, why? Presumably, there's been a certain rapacious commercial. We want the streets, some of the businesses, some corporations, somewhere in the last 100 years or 110 years, 108 years, whatever. What made the change?
Well, the law was gradually chipped away. At first, it was that they couldn't sell on certain streets. Then it was they limited it to a certain number of disabled vets, as if the supply of disabled vets was going to arbitrarily end. Quite the contrary, obviously. They gave 60 of them, believe it or not, a special right to vend in Midtown, and then denied it to the rest of them. And this is certainly another one of the complaints in the lawsuit, that in terms of the legal action that's being taken. At one point, they actually basically banned them all together, and then that was revoked because of political pressure. Certainly, there are many people who don't like vendors for whatever reason, but there are very few people who can legitimately say that they have a problem with disabled veterans. And most people, whatever their feelings about war or the government, I think we could assume would be sympathetic to someone that was wounded in combat defending their country. This is not exactly a controversial group of people where half of America doesn't like them and the other half doesn't know. This is a group of people that virtually every person in this country would say that they should support them. So the politicians that make these laws, at the same time that they are taking away the rights of the veterans, they make these incredible speeches talking about how much they respect the veterans, how much they want to help them, how much they want to do everything for them. And it, of course, it's all complete double talk. But like so much in politics, you've got to look behind the story to see what they're actually up to. And in this case, what they're actually up to is literally 180 degrees from what they're saying.
So this victory was fairly recent in court? Or this, I should say, the victory where the judge has exposed the clear motivation behind the placement of planters and the campaign to drive away.
Right. This happened in the early part of June.
Huh.
And the ramifications for it are barely being felt yet. There's going to be a lot more to come. 2 weeks ago, Donald Trump, I'm sure your listeners know who he is, he decided that he was sick and tired of seeing disabled veterans on Fifth Avenue. So he went to the media, he got on about three different TV news shows and in the New York Post, and he denounced disabled veteran vendors. He demanded that Mayor Bloomberg eliminate them from the streets, and then he claimed that none of them were actually disabled veterans. Well, the next day, we went to Trump Tower, myself and the disabled vets. We did a protest. We were on network television in just about every city in the United States. We got in the New York Times and other newspapers, and we denounced Donald Trump. We made it clear Trump was a chump, that Trump was against vendors, and we let him hear from us, and there's probably going to be further confrontations with Donald Trump. He's one of the main members of the Fifth Avenue Business Improvement District, which is the main business group that was behind changing this law about disabled veterans so as to eliminate them from Midtown.
Tell us what a business improvement district is, and it's kind of about the rise of the business improvement districts, if you know anything of the history.
Well, I'll give you an example of the rise of it. Most people would attribute it to New York City is where they began. And as your listeners know, but pre-Giuliani, let's say, New York was in pretty bad shape. The streets were filthy, the economy was messed up, it was dangerous in the streets. And business people got together and they said, basically, if the government can't take care of these problems, we will. They got a law passed, which allowed them to form these discrete districts within the city and to assess a tax from based on the square footage of every commercial property in the district. So, for example, let's say you have a big store on Fifth Avenue. Besides paying all the federal, state, and city taxes that you pay, there's an additional tax based on the square footage of your property that you have to pay to the bid. the business improvement district. If you don't pay it, they can go to court and seize and liquidate your property. So this isn't a voluntary thing. Once a new business improvement district is created and you're in it, you're part of it whether you like it or not. Now, unlike the government, where you can, every few years, you get a chance to at least have the illusion of voting them out of office, there's nothing much you can do to get rid of these people. If you have the misfortune of being in their district, you can move your business or else you're stuck with them. You don't really get to choose them. The people that create the bid basically run it. And as a result, most of New York City has now been carved up into these business improvement districts. Now, what do? They basically provide three things. Security, they have their own private police forces that patrol the streets. I'm not talking about in the stores. They're out there on the public sidewalk, not police officers, just guys that they hire. They do sanitation. Is that they put street furniture, garbage cans, planters, poles, signs, kiosks, all over the sidewalk, covered with their logos, owned by them on city property. I liken these bids to the mafia, because in a sense, how did the mafia really make its money? In the beginning, especially, it was about a protection racket. You go to a business, you say, hey, look, you know, somebody could come in here and break that window. And if you pay me $50 a week, I'll make sure the window doesn't break. And if you say, well, nobody's breaking my window, the guy goes out and breaks the window and says, you see how that could work? And then every week you pay him $50 to not break your window. So the bids have shaken down all these businesses, and we're not talking mom-and-pop stores here. Every business in the district has to pay, whether it's a little bodega or it's Macy's or Tiffany's or Trump Tower. And obviously a property like Trump Tower, if you consider that it's probably got millions of square feet, they're paying a huge amount of money to the bid. So they expect that the bid is going to do a lot for them. And the main thing that the bid does, besides reproducing the same city services that you're already paying for, sanitation, security, and basically keeping the sidewalks in good condition, you're already paying for those things with your taxes. The main thing that the bids really do is try to get rid of vendors, not surprisingly. And this is how I got tuned into the bids and became an opponent of them, because the average person would look at the bids and say, it's wonderful, look at that, they clean the streets. They put their own garbage can. They got all kinds of an army of guys in uniforms running around on the sidewalk telling people you can't do this, you can't do that. Looks pretty good to me. But if you're a vendor, you feel the full brunt of what these people do. And it's all extra legal. They're not the police. They have no more legal right to do any of these things than I do. And they basically seize all of this public property, which in a place like New York City is of inestimable value. Imagine what the value of all the public spaces in New York City is. It's worth trillions of dollars. You can't even put a figure on it, whether it's for advertising or anything else. So by seizing this property, the bids are basically turning it over to corporate interests. The bids in New York City were started by some of the biggest media and real estate companies in the world. These are multi-billion dollar companies. They've had designs on owning all these public spaces and exploiting them. And now through the bid system, they basically own them without ever having to buy them. And they spend a lot of time denying access to them to the general public. So just very briefly, how does that work out? When I and the vets showed up in front of Trump Tower a few weeks ago to do a protest, within 1 minute, 20 cops showed up. Oh, you can't do that here. You have to have a permit. Now, there is no permit for doing a protest that's not out in the street. You don't need any permit, which fortunately I knew. I told the cops, call One Police Plaza, that's the police headquarters, tell them Robert Letterman says he doesn't need a permit. Look it up in the police rules. They did. They came back and said, you're right, and they left us alone. But the average person at that point would have backed down because here's 20 cops telling them, we're going to have to arrest you because you don't have a permit. And what does that mean? That they've basically eviscerated the First Amendment right off the most important street in New York City, Fifth Avenue. And Mayor Bloomberg is a huge supporter of BIDs. And Mayor Bloomberg, in fact, in recent weeks has been going on the media and telling the public, yes, you need a permit. You can demonstrate anytime you want, but you have to have a permit. And that's exactly not true. What the First Amendment says, literally, is Congress shall make no law abridging, restricting freedom of speech. And what could restrict speech more than that you have to go to the government that you're going to protest against and ask them for permission to protest? That not only making the permit difficult to get will stop speech, but simply the fact that you have to get a permit, that you have to give your name and your address and your phone number and explain to the authorities you're going to protest against who you are and what you're going to do, that's going to discourage 98% of all possible protests right there. People will be intimidated, even in the best of political climates, let alone the one we're living in, where recently a friend of mine was arrested because the police thought he taped up a picture of Bush in a museum. It turned out he didn't even do it.
Well, I was reading, I guess, a few days ago about the case of Robert Humphreys. You remember him? Humphreys is serving 37 months in a federal jail for making a joke about Bush. He was convicted by a Portland jury. His joke was actually made before 9/11, and had to do with the burning bush, and that they interpreted it as a threat to throw flammable liquid on the president. 37 months in a federal pen. You also mentioned, we're talking, by the way, with Robert Letterman, who is, what are you, co-founder of Artist, or you are the actual founder? Or?
I'm certainly one of the founders, and I'm the president of Artist, which stands for Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics.
And you mentioned you've been mentioning the disabled veterans and the attack on them, but you also mentioned in the email I'm reading here, taking the vendors out of vending, a broader attack on the war against vendors, a comprehensive vending law, and you discuss the different kinds of vendors and the kinds of lures that are being used to attack vendors generally. I guess, does this include First Amendment individuals, or are we talking about people who are simply commercial vendors?
Well, as you understand, there's a mixture of different classes or categories.
Talk
of
about
vendors.
That mixture, could you, and what that's
sure.
about?
Sure. Well, there's obviously this First Amendment protected vendors, which is anyone selling newspapers, books, art, photographs, records, CDs, DVDs, anything else that's clearly protected by past Supreme Court and federal court rulings about what is First Amendment protected. Then there are general vendors. These are people with a vending license. First Amendment protectors don't need a license. General vendors are selling what's called general merchandise, which could be virtually anything you'd find at any store. It could be clothing, jewelry, dry goods, batteries. Then you have food vendors. Obviously, these are people that sell food. They need not only a vending license, they need a special food handling certificate from the Department of Health. And then you have veteran vendors, non-disabled veteran vendors, which is anybody that served in the military. They're entitled to a vending license on request. And then you have disabled veteran vendors. Anyone that can prove that they were disabled while in the service, they get a special license, which gives them special rights. And then you have a last group, which is illegal vendors, which includes both people that are selling legitimate merchandise who simply don't have a license because there aren't any available, plus people selling black market merchandise, bootlegged CDs, counterfeit handbags, and the like. So there's basically about six different classes of vendors in the city, and each group has somewhat different laws, somewhat different rights and restrictions.
But there's a general war on vending, you say, coming up beyond the disabled attack on disabled veterans in terms of a comprehensive vending law that's being proposed?
Right. Well, the city is now has been working on a what they call a comprehensive vending law, which is to change all the past vending laws, which are go back more than 100 years, and to make one new uniform law, putting all those different groups into one category, and then putting vendors and street furniture in the same category. Now, the reason that they want to do this is, as I alluded to before, that all the street furniture that exists now and that they plan to install, they've just put out a contract for 4,000 sidewalk advertising kiosks. All of those are going to go along the curb, which is where vendors can legally sell. So the city has two problems with this. One is you can only put so many things in the same space. And the other is if they're going to try to charge Disney or Sony or McDonald's $1 million to put a single ad on the corner, and then I can stand next to that ad and do my thing for free, aren't Disney and Sony and Nike, aren't they going to complain and say, why would I have to pay $1 million and Letterman is out there for free doing, he's advertising his stuff, nobody's charging him, why do I have to pay? So the city's solution to this problem is to get rid of the people that have the right to be there. And in the parks, this is literally what's going on. I won a lawsuit about making it legal to vend in parks without a license in 2001. Now what you're getting in different parks in New York City is literally Clear Channel Communications, Sony, Nike, Disney setting up huge tents in these public parks, displacing the vendors, and then the Parks Department police harassing and illegally summonsing and in some cases arresting the vendors. The reason is not because the vendors are in the way of the Disney and Sony and Clear Channel promotional things. It's that these corporations are complaining, why am I paying the park $1 million to set up this tent and these artists right next to me for free? So the purpose of this comprehensive vending law is to get rid of the vendors, basically what I call taking the vendors out of vending. And why do I call it that? The city has no intention whatsoever to get rid of vending, just the opposite. They are actually soliciting corporations to become vendors. The Parks Department alone puts out a monthly solicitation offer, which I get, and they're looking for thousands of new vending stands in the parks at the same time that to the media and to the city council, they're claiming that a handful of street artists are destroying the parks and over-commercializing it. On the streets, the city wants to sell thousands of vending spots through a bidding system to the highest bidder, and the highest bidders will, of course, be the biggest corporations. There'll be the newspapers, there'll be the McDonald's, there'll be the Disney souvenir stands. These are the people that are going to buy 1,000 vending spots at a time for tens of millions of dollars. No vendor presently working in the city could have any chance to outbid these people. So what I'm getting at here is the city is lying about the whole thing in terms of the vending so-called controversy. They don't want to get rid of vending. They want to actually increase vending. They don't want to stop congestion on the sidewalk. They have plans to dramatically increase congestion. And all of it's about advertising revenue, basically, which is going to be in the hands of these giant conglomerates. As I'm sure your listeners know, there's four or five companies now that basically own all the newspapers and all the TV stations. And soon, they're going to own all these digital advertising kiosks that are going to be on all the streets in all the cities in America. And these aren't going to be, you know, the ad kiosks we're all used to, where some guy comes down at 3 in the morning with a bucket of glue and slaps up a poster. These are going to be digital. They're going to be sound. They're going to be video. Not only that, they already have technology developed, which they've experimented with in airports and train stations, where the the kiosk will be able to read things like the chip in your credit card as you walk by. It'll ID you. It'll make a profile of you. It'll say, okay, Robert Letterman, he's 53-year-old, white male. He likes to buy this kind of computer equipment. And the ad that will appear as you walk by will be pitched to you directly.
Just like in the Minority Report.
Exactly. That's not science fiction. That exists right now. They have it in Japan. They've experimented with it in different places in the United States, and that's the wave of the future. Once everybody has these chips in their credit cards, which, you know, they're already selling it, and you see it advertised every time you turn on TV. The blue card, for example, has a little chip in it. Every one of these kiosks is going to be able to know who you are, what kind of things you buy, what you're interested in, how old you are, what your address is. You'll walk past it, you'll get home, there'll be a message for you on your answering machine. Robert Letterman, we know you were interested in that beer. Here's a special coupon. You know, some of it is fantastic. Some of it is great. It's great for the consumers and so on, and it's the marvels of modern technology. Some of it is obviously very threatening and frightening and beyond anything in Big Brother that people 50 years ago could have imagined.
We're talking with Robert Letterman of Artist's Response to Illegal State Tactics in New Jersey, but also probably wanders into New York every so often.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to contact Robert to ask a question, you can't call the studio because there's no other phone line, but you can email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, rnorse, R-N-O-R-S-E, number 3, at hotmail.com, and I'll try to pass on the question to you, Robert. How much time have you got to continue?
I could talk for another 10 minutes, if that's okay.
Sure. Let's go on. If you got questions, rnorse3@hotmail.com. Let's see. I made a few notes, but have we covered the you mentioned this comprehensive vending law that's being proposed. Talk a little bit about your victories here in Santa Cruz. The victories are so few and far between that we get pretty discouraged. You've had a number of victories over the last couple of decades. Want to kind of give us a roster of them?
Well, you know, most my whole life I was a street artist, totally non-political, didn't know anything about law. My knowledge of the First Amendment was the same as most people's. Oh, yeah, that protects free speech. That was the full extent of what I knew or cared about it. Then when Giuliani became mayor, he launched this crackdown on street artists. And by serendipity or whatever, I just happened to have bought a computer at that time, talking the beginning of 94. I got online. We formed a group. I became the president of it. Suddenly I needed to do some research on First Amendment issues, and I had the means to do it right from my house. I had to write leaflets about our cause. I had to hold press conferences and organize protests, and I had to file a lawsuit. And in the past 10 years, I've won 4 federal lawsuits, which have changed some very significant laws affecting the First Amendment. Obviously, I've won laws about selling art on the street and selling art in parks. I also won a lawsuit called Letterman v. United States of America, which made it legal to protest in front of the U.S. Capitol without getting a permit. And that ruling actually came down shortly after 9/11, and the justices in the appeals court ruled that even in light of September 11th, and the security concerns, obviously, at the U.S. Capitol, that it wasn't reasonable for the government to impose a permit requirement for even one person who might want to stand there and give out leaflets, which is what I was doing. I actually wasn't even protesting. I was giving the senators and congressmen leaflets about Giuliani having the artists arrested, and the police had a few hours long confrontation with me, telling me they would have to arrest me if I wouldn't stop doing it, and I refused to back down, and they did arrest me. I won the criminal case and then won the federal case about it. It went through the appeals courts.
In fact, you've been arrested at least, what, 40-odd times?
Or? I've been arrested 41 times on First Amendment issues. I never convicted, never plea bargained, never had to pay a fine, had to go through a lot of crap, certainly. Being arrested, for anybody who hasn't experienced it, is a humiliating and frightening experience. Being handcuffed, thrown in a police car, even if you're a middle-class white person and you're with white officers and you know you didn't do anything wrong and you're going to be released in a few hours, it's still frightening. One can only imagine if you're a black person and there are white cops and you don't know what's going to be happening next.
Have you ever been abused by the police physically?
I have. I've had to sue some police officer. I'm certainly not a pro-police person, but I would have to say that most of the police that I've dealt with treated me respectfully, did nothing to abuse me, told me in many cases, we're really sorry, we've been forced to arrest you, we don't think you did anything wrong, in fact, we agree with you. Occasionally, officers have been very physically abusive, and those officers I've sued as individuals. Normally, I don't sue police officers just who happen to have been ordered to arrest me. And in many of my arrests, these arrests were directly ordered by the highest city officials, most of them, of course, by Rudy Giuliani himself. So I had arrests where 100 police would come to arrest just me for holding up a sign. So these were pretty dramatic political arrests, and they got a lot of publicity attendant to them. And the lawsuits got a lot of attention also. And as a result, I got a lot of experience in dealing with the media, in talking about the First Amendment, in organizing protests. I've personally organized about 250 protests. Never sought a permit, never got a permit, never was arrested for not having a protest permit, even though I was threatened with it at virtually every single arrest, at every single protest. So, you know, my experience of the government in terms of the First Amendment, it's really simple. I mean, if you look at the history of the First Amendment, they didn't write a First Amendment because they knew that the government was going to protect our rights to freedom of speech. They did it to protect us from the government. This was their way of guaranteeing that when the government tries to shut you up, that you'll still be able to communicate. And frankly, from my own background to what I see in other people, the people of this country don't have a clue about how important the First Amendment is to their day-to-day life, religiously, politically, socially, sexually, in terms of their families, everything you do that involves communication.
We're talking with Robert Letterman. You can email in at rnorse3@hotmail.com if you have any questions. Robert, you probably know that I'm concerned a lot with the rights of poor and homeless people.
Right.
You have seen the situation under both Giuliani and now Mayor Bloomberg? Or is it Bloomberg?
Bloomberg.
Is the situation changing in terms of services, in terms of civil rights? And what's the general picture look like for civil liberties under the relatively new mayor compared with Giuliani?
Well, you know, Bloomberg obviously is a different person than Giuliani. I actually prefer Giuliani because he was more upfront about who he was and what he was doing. Bloomberg, on the one hand, claims to be a big advocate for free speech. He's a multi-billionaire who owns a huge media company. So you would think, hey, if anybody's going to care about free speech, it's a guy that owns a media company, right? And he gives hundreds of millions of dollars to the arts. At the same time, he's more repressive about free speech than Giuliani was, and he's doing more to try to get rid of street artists than Giuliani was. So I'm not a big fan. I don't dislike the guy personally. I just don't like what he's doing. He's got certainly a very difficult job. To be the mayor of New York in the best of times is, as they say, the second toughest job in America. And certainly after 9/11, you'd have to be crazy to want that job, especially where every day they announce we can expect another terrorist attack here in New York City. But as far as his policies toward the First Amendment, they're terrible. And his own understanding of the First Amendment seems to be even more flawed than Giuliani's was. So unfortunately, I can't give anybody a very positive report about free speech under Mayor Bloomberg. As far as homelessness, and as you know, I was homeless myself at one point. There was an initial period pre 9/11, let's say, where the homeless situation got better, the economy was doing better in New York, and so on. And then since 9/11, the economy took a huge downturn nationwide and certainly in New York. There's a whole new class of homeless people who were really, you know, breadwinners and executives and working people of all different classes and races and groups, families, entire families that are homeless. The city's services haven't improved in the slightest. That you have the same horrifying homeless shelters that most people refuse to go to because they're too dangerous. And the city is certainly no less hostile toward homeless people who want to camp out on the sidewalk or who would dare to sleep on a park bench or hang out in a park. They're treated more aggressively than rats. They're threatened, they're arrested, they're harassed in every conceivable way. There's literally no public place where a homeless person is tolerated in this city. I mean, you might get away with it for an hour, but as far as, you know, semi-permanently occupying some corner somewhere on a side street in front of an abandoned building or in an empty lot even, they're not going to let you do it, let alone, I mean, if you dare to lay down or to sit down on Fifth Avenue, you'd be surrounded by police within moments. I know you have that crazy law about sitting on the sidewalk in your city. I could tell you that here, there's no law against sitting on the sidewalk, none at all. But if you did it, they would act like you had unpacked a small nuclear device and were getting ready to blow up the city. That's how seriously they would take it.
Here in Santa Cruz, we have a law, I may have told it to you before, it's called the move-along law, where you cannot have a so-called display device, which is a table, can be anything as small as a hat with a little sign in it, or an open guitar case for a street performer, for more than an hour. And attorneys locally, some have been wary of taking cases attacking the constitutionality of this law because they feel it might be construed by the current Supreme Court as an appropriate regulation of time, place, and manner. What's your sense on that?
Well, there's no law like that here. You can perform anywhere in the city as long as you don't use amplification. There's no time limit. Obviously, if you're creating some kind of a nuisance, you're blocking a doorway or whatever, or covering the whole sidewalk and not letting people pass, you got a problem. But there's no law against it. You can panhandle virtually anywhere legally in New York City. There's a law about it. As far as a one-hour time limit being constitutional, based on what? Certainly not security. They cite, you know, security concerns about everything now. So my response to that would be, if you can stop for an hour, how would stopping for an hour and a half jeopardize security? It doesn't make any sense. If you're stopping is the jeopardizing security, then you can't stop at all. And then if you can't stop at all, what does that mean? You're carrying groceries and you put them down to look at your watch, you're going to be under arrest. They can't make a law like that. So I would certainly, if they made such a law in New York, I would feel obliged to try to challenge it. And I'd certainly probably be standing in a line of people trying to challenge it. It would have no chance to survive in this city, certainly without being challenged. And I'll say this, you know, I was heartened in recent weeks by certain Supreme Court decisions, which, surprisingly, even on politically controversial issues like internet pornography, the Supreme Court declined to support certain restrictions. Even the Bush Supreme Court.
Of course, you do have to give your name now, even under reasonable suspicion.
Well, I don't know that I find that so onerous, frankly. Even pre 9/11 and terrorism and so on, I don't know that it's such an invasion of your privacy if a police officer asks your name to give it. Other people certainly can have different opinions about that. I didn't find that to be such a terrible ruling, but certainly it's not the fulfillment of total freedom. I don't think we're going to ever see the freedom that, I don't know how old you are, but anybody that's over 20 years old, the freedom that we grew up with in this country, you're never going to see it again. There's no way you're ever going to see it again. The question is, are you going to see any kind of freedom? Is any of the freedom that we had going to still be there a few years from now?
How about the freedom to chalk on the sidewalk? We have people have been convicted of using erasable chalk on the sidewalk to write peace messages, draw peace signs, concerns about the homeless. What's the situation in New York City?
Well, I was arrested about 15 times for writing with chalk. I'm the only person in the whole city that's ever been arrested for it. Needless to say, I was writing Giuliani equals police state, and I was arrested by an army of police. Other than that, in New York City, not only do they let people chalk, but they actually sponsor chalking festivals throughout the year in parks, on city streets. In fact, there's a festival on Fifth Avenue itself, the most important street in the city commercially, where it's an entire mile of chalking called the Museum Mile. And the city gives you the chalk, and they have police there to protect you while you're doing the chalking. At the same time, on the books, it's illegal to write with chalk, but they selectively enforce it. I'm the only person that they've arrested for it.
Were you convicted?
Never. I've never been convicted.
Even though they presumably could, given the wording of the law.
Well, see, the thing with criminal court is once they convict you, they open the door to an appeal. So in New York, when you get arrested as an activist, the chances of you being convicted are very, very, very small, no matter what you did, because it's one thing to go and bring a lawsuit in federal court on your own. There's a lot of hurdles to it. Most people don't ever get it together. But a criminal case, because the city has to pay for your lawyer in most cases, and because the threshold in criminal cases is quite different than in civil cases, if they were to have convicted me for chalking, I would have been able to go into the appeal court, and I would have gotten that established that it was now legal to write with chalk, in my opinion. I did a lot of research on chalking all over the country. It's very common in universities where they have an official chalking policy where you're allowed to chalk as long as you don't use racial slurs, for example. Chalking is common all over the United States. Obviously, most of us were given chalk as children by our teachers and parents and so on, and freely chalk to our heart's content. And I think that's pretty much all over the United States.
But not
so
in Santa Cruz.
What's that?
Not in Santa Cruz.
Well, Santa Cruz seems to be leading the way in certain violations of freedom from everything I hear about it.
Finally, Robert Letterman, let me ask you, what's your sense of the current feeling around the Iraqi war? Here in Santa Cruz, some of us are really pressing to see U.S. troops removed very quickly from Iraq. Is there a more of a sentiment for sending more troops as presidential aspirant Kerry wants to do, or I don't know, muddling along as Bush wants to do with 130,000 troops? Do you have any sense of that? I know we're a bit off the topic, but I got you on the line. So,
well, I like to speak in general on things that I'm at least somewhat expert in. Like most people, certainly I have some opinions about Iraq. I think I'm generally in the camp that sees it as a total disaster, whatever we do. If we withdrew, it would be a disaster. If we send 100,000 more troops there, it'll be a disaster. Bush has, rather than made a war on terror, he's dramatically increased terrorism and made it attractive to millions of people that never would have even considered it before. He's radicalized the Muslim world in a way that no Muslim leader ever could have done. He's made the United States and Americans the most hated people on earth. Not that we were necessarily the most loved before, but I think even in many Muslim countries, there are people that respected us, admired us. I mean, he has made our name dirt throughout the world. He's shamed the military. He's shamed the intelligence services. He's shamed the government itself. If he isn't removed from office, I mean, considering that the last president, that we went through years of impeachment about him having a private sexual act, if G.W. Bush isn't impeached, if he's not unelected after this next November, then we literally have one of the biggest war criminals in history running this country. And where things are going to go from there is anybody's guess. I think it's certainly, the problem is not going to be limited to Iraq, because we're making enemies everywhere. Even in Europe, we're making enemies out of our previous allies. And we're inspiring terrorism. People wonder about terrorists. I certainly am not soft on terrorism. I'm Jewish. And when I read all that goes on in Israel every day, done by terrorists, it certainly angers me. But frankly, you have to understand that there is something to terrorism when people have no other way to get their message across. No free speech, no chance to sue, no chance to have elections. They're going to do something. They're not good. People will not just sit and take it indefinitely. So if you go to abuse people and rape their countries and force your policies down their throat, they're going to do something to fight back. And if they have no other way to do it, terrorism is the way that they're going to turn to. And Bush has made, I mean, the news every day is almost like a terrorism primer. It instructs people how to be a terrorist, how to effectively control the media with your terrorist act, how to manipulate a government, even how to manipulate elections by terrorism. I mean, if this guy thinks he's stopping terrorism by the things he's doing, if he actually believes that, he's insane. And the people that are supporting him in it, I don't think they could be as stupid as they seem. So I can only imagine that they're actually trying to increase terrorism, that the agenda is to make as much chaos as possible, and that there are benefits to them economically that will come from that, and that's the real game plan. And if that's the case, then rather than make peace in Iraq or resolve the problem, what their game plan probably is to make things a lot worse.
Well, right now, there are, as you know, 130,000 troops there.
I feel sorry for those troops.
Are you? I'm not so much looking for your personal position, but I'm looking for the sentiment in New York City. Here, some of us, again, are looking for whatever candidate, you know, you vote for in November, you make that choice then. The question, though, for a lot of us is, at least with respect to that policy, is there a growing sentiment for that policy, for those troops to be withdrawn, not in 2006, not in 2005, but as soon as possible?
I don't think there's a sentiment to withdraw the troops.
Uh-huh.
There's certainly a very strong anti-Bush sentiment in New York, which happened before he was even first in office. So it's not hard to find people who are against Bush in New York City. But I think partly also because of 9/11, people here in general feel something, you know, quote-unquote, something must be done. And they certainly, I wouldn't imagine, are leaning towards withdrawing our military from the Middle East in any way, shape, or form. So if anything, as recent news articles make pretty clear, they may have to bring back the draft, because you're not going to find too many people volunteering to go over there at this point. And from all the indications, when we get, you know, Iraq is going to become a bigger problem, and then there are other countries that are going to become a big problem. And we can look forward to quite a few years of increasing warfare, as far as I could see, even under the best of circumstances and with a good president, let alone with the people we have, who seem to be intent on destroying as much of the world as they possibly can.
We've been talking with Robert Letterman of New York City. His group is ARTIST, and that stands for
Artists' Response to Illegal State Tactics.
Yes. Lots more questions for you, but you've stayed beyond the time you said you would be available for. I appreciate your spending an hour with us. And if people want to get in touch with you, what should they do?
They can email me. My email address is robert.lederman, L-E-D-E-R-M-A-N, at att.net.
Robert.lederman at att.net. How about a website?
It's too complicated to say it verbally. Too many slashes. And
how about a Google place?
Yeah, well, if you do a Google on Robert Letterman in quotes, you'll find thousands of articles I've written, including my website.
That sounds good to me. Robert, really instructive as ever, and appreciate you taking the time on a Sunday, 4th of July. Any final comments on the 4th of July?
Hey, you know, we should never confuse the country with the people that are running it. Whatever flaws we have, and certainly we have a mighty flawed history, America is the greatest country on earth with the greatest system. And if we really love this country, we need to protect it from the people that are trying to destroy it. And unfortunately, those are the people running it. And the most important thing about America is free speech. That's what makes it different than any other country that ever existed. Plenty of rich countries in the past and the present, plenty of great technology in other places, plenty of good people, plenty of religious beliefs and values and everything else. Nothing unique about that. But freedom of speech is the thing that sets us apart from every other country that's ever been or that is. And the day that more Americans understand the value of that very simple one-sentence thing in the Constitution, the greater this country's protection from our enemies will be. So happy 4th of July to all your listeners.
Hey, thank you, Robert. Take care.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Hey, bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Robert Letterman speaking to us live from New Jersey. Again, if you want to reach him, you can Google for Robert Letterman in quotes, Letterman spelled L-E-D-E-R-M-A-N. He's also reachable directly by email at robert.letterman at att.net. You can reach us at rnorse3 at hotmail.com, or you can call in because phone lines are now open, 427-3772. About 20 years ago, the Philadelphia police firebombed a black organization called MOVE. This next song is about that. Another song by Mark Levy. Stay with us.
Now I sympathize with the homeless.
Correction. It's about the homeless. Stay with us anyway.
When I see him on the evening news, somewhere there must be a place where they can park their weary shoes. Maybe a camp in the country or a building on the edge of town. But that shelter there across the street is only gonna get me down. Everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. See, I don't want to have to lock my door to be inside, safe and sound. This neighborhood will go to pot with the likes of them around. It's no fun out there in the cold. Yes, I know just how they feel. But I just can't bear to see a hungry face when I'm eating a nice warm meal. Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective health, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. I've got a friend who owns a store about a half a block away. Every year she donates goods and money to United Way. But she thinks it's bad for business to have the homeless walking by. She says, why not send them south for the winter so they can stay warm and dry? Oh, everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective healths, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Well, now please understand our position. It's not the way it looks. We want them housed, but out of sight. There are zoning laws on the books. Long as we can clear our conscience and preserve our civic pride, we'll give our consent, even pay the rent on a place where they can hide. 'Cause everybody should have a home. Everybody must be fed. Everyone has a right to a roof and below it a nice warm bed. We applaud your noble efforts at guarding their collective healths, and we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else. Yes, we'll gladly give you funds and food long as you can put them somewhere else.
Mark Levy again. That was, again, for Take Off Your Clothes, and it was The Homeless Shuffle.